this is Aaron Moore of the Gods, coming at you in the cyber world of Mark After Dark. Keep on rocking, y'all.
Mad. Mark After Dark, the man that hates everything except the real thing. Coming to you, live on the air. This is my ongoing interview with rock and roll legend, Eric Moore of the Gods.
We'll start with the beginning of your career. What would you say was the biggest influence in your life that inspired you to make music your life?
The one in the ads in the paper for a gunfighter.
Okay. What led to you picking guitar and bass as your instrument?
Well, I started on mandolin in church because that's what was open.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had guitar open, and I switched to guitar. And then when I got kicked out of church, it was, you know, just typical long hair, rock and roll, the Beatles versus, you know, the church.
Mm-hmm.
I love the church. The Gods is called what it's called. Not to be blasphemous, it's meant to have something to do with that, with performing a service for people.
Mm-hmm.
I seriously considered doing that as a living. John and I were just talking about it. I was going to go to Josephinian Theological College, and
mm-hmm.
I was seriously thinking about it. The Gods happened the way it happened, and I'm glad that it did. And it serves the same purpose. It provides people with somebody that cares about them and likes to give them some solace and a little relief. And, you know, I give a damn if they're sick or they have a baby or if they're happy or anything. That's my job. I like doing that. And that's what I do, and that's what the Gods are about and always have been about.
Your professional music career began in 1970 with a band called Tree. Despite winning a record contract with RCA in a statewide battle of the bands, the group did not succeed. What did Tree sound like, and what did you gain from that experience?
We sounded a lot like Free. We were a trio with a singer, and it's just your basic power trio with a singer, and a lot of the sounds that you know, our tapes and stuff came out, it sounded like Free. We didn't have production geniuses that Free had. You know, some of those people were just incredible. But that's the kind of feel that we were going for, and winning the state battle with bands was a big deal. You know, when you're a kid, that's a big
deal.
And the recording contract went nowhere because in 1970, there really wasn't much of a recording industry in the Midwest. You didn't have the studios that you have now and the interest and stuff. And the only two centers you had three centers. You had Nashville and you had Chicago, and neither one of them were big rock and roll places. And you had Detroit, and there wasn't a whole lot of white Detroit power happening.
Mm-hmm.
In 1970. You know, you had Motown and all that kind of stuff happening. So bands like us and Brownsville Station and all, you know, we all work for a company called DMA, Diversified
yeah.
Management, and, you know, Ann Arbor and Detroit. And it was just, they were real good times for being there and living it and everything. They were revolutionary times.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the business goes, it was real hard to build something out of there.
Mm-hmm. You then established an outfit called Mixed Water.
I didn't establish Mixed Water. That was Bob Hill.
Yeah, that's what I was getting, featuring your future guitarist, Bob Hill.
Yeah.
When Jamie Lyons joined the group, it became the Capital City Rockets.
Uh-huh.
An album was recorded on the Elektra label in 73, July 73, if I'm not mistaken.
Despite being an excellent effort, the band soon after broke up due to personality conflicts and alcohol problems. Can you explain the details of the group's demise?
Yeah, it was a real mess. We had, I won't name who the players were in each one of these little dramas, but we had a woman who had a child who was a wife of one of the guys in the band. We all lived in a big house out in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for the first few months there, that was way cool. It was everything you could ever want a rock and roll band to be. You got the rent paid, you're making money, you're playing, you're living right in Hollywood. Things were pretty cool. But the only trouble is, we had everybody's girlfriend and wife was out there living with us, and they had this thing. It was like the old ladies' band. They would have their own little band meetings, and you know, decide things for our careers and stuff. And some guys could keep their women in place, and some guys really couldn't.
Oh, that sucks.
And that's what destroyed the band. Yeah, everybody drank and did drugs.
Yeah, well, that's a norm.
We never had any problems between us. It was always, if one old lady's fighting another old lady, then your old man's got to stand up for him. And just, you know, which old lady's going to cook? And none of them could cook. And just ridiculous day-to-day living things. And then when one guy's old lady didn't leave him for another man, she just simply moved her and the kid into another bedroom.
Oh, God.
The tension in the house got so incredible, and as soon as we got back to the Midwest and everybody could get their own place again, the last thing most people wanted to do was see anybody else in that band.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a shame because we seriously kicked ass live.
After the breakup of the Capital City Rockets, Bob Hill joined a band called Sky King with
mm-hmm.
Future Gods drummer Glenn Cantaline. You stepped in and took the bass player's place in that band. Since the band played softer rock, what other bands would you compare that sound to?
Oh, Sky King was your typical, we had a female singer, and I'll never work with another one. It was just absurd. It was beyond comedy. You could only look at it in comedic terms to keep you from committing suicide.
Oh my God.
You know, a lot of guys that are in bands with pretty girl singers, you know, secretly they all want to fuck her.
Yeah.
I wanted to kill her.
What did she do?
Just everything that was not rock and roll. One night I went out there and you know, and there was a song that she wasn't singing on, and me and the guys, we laid it out. The audience is screaming, the whole place is on the dance floor wanting more. And she walked on stage pissed off and looked at me and she goes, "Don't get them that riled up again."
Oh my God.
And from that moment on, I only thought of leaving that band and or finding a place to put her fucking body.
When Mark Chatfield was added on guitar along with Hayward Law
mm-hmm.
as a second drummer and Michael Adams on keyboards, the Gods were officially born.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Law and Adams were tragically killed in an auto accident in April 76.
Yeah, we'd made a great demo tape, and we put together a $2,500 promo package. Now, back then, $2,500 into an advertising package was unheard of.
Yeah.
But I was taking all the thing, you know, because in between bands, I'd be like a road manager or, you know, a stage manager and stuff. And I worked as an agent for about 6 months,
mm-hmm.
besides being in bands. And I tried to put all the things that I learned from all the different directions into this idea of the Gods.
Yeah.
But when Mike and Hayward died, that was a pretty severe blow.
How did you deal with it?
Well, that's when I... that week is when I had my first ulcer attack.
Oh, God.
I've been fighting those all my life.
Yeah, I know. I have stomach problems, too.
Yeah, you just, you know, if I was inclined to committing murder and things like that, I wouldn't have an ulcer.
Yeah.
You know, there's just different ways you handle problems, and unfortunately, unless I can kill them, I end up eating them.
Yeah.
It sucks, but when Mike and Hayward went, it hurt a whole lot because we all lived in the same house. That house consisted of a rock and roll band, the road crew,
mm-hmm.
all the hangers-on. equipment. All the motorcycles were inside during the winter.
Yeah.
Our dining room was full of Harley Davidson's, BSA's. We were close, and it was living that rock and roll life every day, and we loved it. If we didn't have money for food, hey, Eric could take a little trip out to the woods, and we'd come back with a half dozen squirrels. one time it got real bad. We shot two groundhogs.
Oh, my God.
We had cream chip groundhog over toast.
Oh, God.
That's right. Gopher on a shingle. That's what we fucking,
it's the rock and roll life.
And it was wonderful. Every day, we would laugh until there were tears in our eyes, at least once.
Yeah. Well, it's...
And they were on their way down to the printing shop to pick up that promo package. The gig got over about 4 in the morning, and they, take a couple hits of speed or whatever, and they'd played a gig the night before, so one or both of them was tripping and doing speed and drunk and stoned. And they went from a 4-lane highway to a 2-lane highway and forgot about it about a mile into the
car.
And they just pulled over into the left lane. And
I just wonder what they would have, I never really heard what
they were exceptionally good. And I've always wanted two drummers.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn and Hayward they were tight like brothers. They could either play exact opposite of each other or exact the same as each other, and they complemented each other. And they went into the idea of two drummers non-competitively. The whole idea was to make this incredibly strong beat, and they did.
After the death of Lon Adams, you received a phone call from your old bandmate Bob Hill, who ended up joining the band, solidifying the Gods' classic lineup. You signed with Casablanca in 77. What was your impression of the label at that time?
It wasn't so much Casablanca, because had it been Casablanca, we had not taken deals from several small Midwest labels. And because back then, you got to remember, we're playing 3 or 4 nights a week. We're doing one-nighters. The majority of our opening acts were signed recording acts, and we weren't. And we were packing all the places here in the Midwest. And we didn't want to sign with some bullshit Midwest label. It's going to have to, depend on somebody else to do all the real work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that came to us weren't Casablanca, because we wouldn't have been receptive to them. And the Gods never got along with any of the Casablanca bullshit disco jive motherfuckers. Hated each and every one of those ridiculous sons of bitches. They knew nothing of rock and roll. They could sell the shit out of Parliament. I liked Parliament of the bunch.
Well,
he was a different creature. He wasn't that disco asshole.
Donna
Summers and the Village People kind of assholes. We would do a gig in a town where Casablanca was real strong, and for the after gig party, we'd end up in a fag after hours joint with a whole bunch of these New York City record company people, and if any of them are still in the business, they can suck my dick too.
In a 1977 issue of Northeastern Ohio Scene magazine dated April 13th through 19th, 1978, volume 9, number 14, the article was entitled "The Gods at the OK Corral," written by Gary Lupica. You were quoted in the article as saying, "The Gods set the attendance record at the Agora Ballroom in Cleve, Ohio." How important was it for the band to be noticed for its live shows at that time?
Well, the live shows is what got us our record deals. The fact that all of our opening acts had record deals and the headliner didn't, brought in a lot of record companies.
Mm-hmm.
When the Einar Brothers came in from Millennium Records, they said that, they looked at the audience, and the place had a fire ticket for 700 people, and we got paid for almost 2,200 people. And if you're getting paid for that much, there was a couple hundred more that they're not reporting.
Wow.
So, it was actually kind of scary. We had people falling off the balcony, and with people getting scrunched up against the front of the stage, and I had to send my security down. You know, there was one girl that had gotten knocked down, and she was being trampled.
Wow.
And I had to send my security down, all of them, to get her out of there and to back people off the front so no one else would be hurt. You know, we were sending attendance records everywhere we went. When we played the Cleveland Agora, we did it at 11 o'clock in the morning. They called it the Coffee Break Concert. And, of course, we'd been up all night partying. And we went in there, you know, all burnt and everything. But we still did a really great show. I've got a tape somewhere.
Well, let's hope we hear it. with all your stuff coming out this year.
Yeah, we've got, you know, the Vault Walton, and mm-hmm. we've got Canadian 4 and all this other stuff coming out, and we'll be going through tapes and editing them. We'll find that. But what happened up there was we set the attendance record, and then 3 or 4 months later, Todd Rundgren came to town and broke our attendance record. We turned right back around and did another God show there and got the attendance record back to the gods. Then the place burnt down.
Wow.
So we own the attendance record. It ain't going nowhere now.
Did you realize you were going to burn the place down after you?
Yeah, I didn't light the match, but, you know, the place burnt down. And I'm sorry it didn't burn down, not just for that, but because the Latani family that owned all the Agoras across the United States, at one time there were 22 of them, they had just signed on to finance a film, and it was just, you know, a biker version of Scarface. You know, drug smugglers and people getting killed and all that kind of shit. But it was set in the world of bikers. Mm-hmm. And they sent me a script, and they wanted me to write the soundtrack for it. So I wrote the soundtrack for it. While I was in that frame of mind, I even wrote a Harley Davidson commercial and a couple of writing songs that didn't have anything to do with the movie. But, you know, one of them, In the Wind, is now on my song list. And it was good stuff.
Your first album was recorded in August 1977 and released in early 1978. Originally, it was supposed to be entitled Rock and Roll Machine, but the Canadian outfit Triumph allegedly stole the name for their new RCA album. Have you ever approached any of the members of Triumph regarding this, and what is your opinion of Triumph's music?
Their big selling point was they had a 100,000-watt light show. I don't consider 1,000 100-watt bulbs to be a 100,000-watt light show, but that's how they ended up getting headline things mm-hmm. and stuff. I never thought Triumph was that awful good as far as what they put out on albums and stuff.
Oh, God.
But man, when you heard them doing things like sound checks and playing this just straight rock and roll and this like Canadian TNT powered folk music or something, I don't know how to describe it, they were real good. And I don't think anyone ever got a chance to see how really good Triumph was. I think they were mismanaged or something.
Rolling Stone magazine, who hated every great hard rock album from AC/DC to ZZ Top, criticized your band as being a miserable hard rock quartet that epitomized the most wretched excesses of 70s rock, which I don't agree with. What did you think of Rolling Stone, and what was your opinion of rock journalism in general back then?
There were some people in rock journalism that were rock and rollers. There was a Toby Memises and all these people from Cream magazine. That was, you know, a lot of people don't even know that that incredible magazine existed.
Well, Cream were my favorite. That's what inspired me.
Cream went into little towns all across the United States, and that magazine, in a lot of ways, was the only touch with the outside world all those as hundreds of thousands of rock and rollers had. And there were some great writers back then, but then again, you had people coming out, and all of a sudden it's Rolling Stones generating millions of dollars. And they start worrying more about journalism students and all these other fucks that have never been on the road, don't know anything about music, and all of a sudden they're deciding what is hip.
Yeah.
People all of a sudden in New York and L.A. are deciding what is hip in rock and roll. I don't even buy it in fashion, much less music or art.
In a February 1978 issue of Cream, talking about Cream, you called Alice Cooper a liar for claiming to drink a case of beer a day. Did you ever meet Alice Cooper and tell him how you felt?
No, and I met him, but I never said that to him because he just finished a gig, and I'm not going to fuck with anybody. Just did their job, man. You know, you've only got about 10% of your life force left in your body, and the last thing you want to do is listen to some ridiculous theory posed by some guy from Columbus, Ohio. I just paid my respects, said hi, and got the fuck out.
On your first album, you included a cover version of a Golden Earring tune called Candy's Going Bad. You worked with Golden Earring back in the early 70s.
Great song, great lyrics. They made it sound so mamby-pamby and you want to puke. It was just, but the words to it were just so intense. The story it was telling.
Mm-hmm.
When I was road managing law for the Licani family,
mm-hmm.
I just did it for a few months to help them out and, you know, and to learn another side of the business. And I ended up at the Youngstown Agora. It was called the Tomorrow Theater then.
Mm-hmm.
And their sound man was sicker than a dog. It was back there when the Hong Kong flu was first happening, and he could not do the show. So I said, okay, I'll do it. Of course, I have no business doing it, but yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
So I go and do it, and I'm through the headphones, I'm hitting them the solo button half the time, listening to the lyrics going, this is really fucking great. And Glenn Cataline was actually the guy who really brought that into the gods. He sang it and he made it real. And, you know, Glenn has nothing to do with rock and roll at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask him right now, he would deny he was ever in the gods.
Which really stinks.
Oh, he has nothing to do with rock and roll. He's never been in a band. That's what he'd tell you. He's vice president of Chase Bank in Columbus, Ohio.
God. I'm sorry.
He had cosmetic surgery to cover up his pierced ear.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, hardcore. But then again, when he joined the band, he already had a degree in business administration, CPA, mm-hmm. all that shit. We put him in charge of the money.
Wow.
Not a penny went anywhere that it wasn't supposed to go.
Wow.
He was real, real good. And he came into it saying, you know, someday I want to be a millionaire banker. And Mark came into it going, someday I want to own a music store. Bob came into it going, you know, I'm going to inherit millions of dollars and someday I'm going to retire and do nothing.
Wow.
And they all did that, and I missed them. And sometimes, you know, if it didn't come down according to the way I had things planned, I'd be mad at them as it came down. But I've gotten over it. They all lived through it in much better shape than I have.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they're doing what they're doing, because we were on an all-star team at one time, and there was a time for a short while that nobody could touch us, and very few people can say that, and I'm proud of that, and I can live with that.
You also opened up for fellow Casablanca label mates, Angel,
yeah.
I hope you did, on their White Hot tour.
Yeah.
The tour?
We did two more tours besides that.
Okay.
We were an easy package to work with.
The tour was billed as Angel and the Gods, a match made in heaven.
Yeah, right.
Would you consider your dealings with Angel as heavenly?
I would consider my dealings with some of the members of Angel as heavenly, because a couple of those guys were honest-to-goodness rock and roll road dogs.
Okay, now we
didn't give a fuck about any of the hype.
Which one was your, which one?
I don't want to get rid of, because a couple of them were absolute nudniks.
I could see which ones.
Yeah, I'm you know, most people know who was.
Yeah.
And, I mean, right, we caught one of them stuffing a sock in his pants. I mean, that is so Spinal Tap, but that was so Angel.
Well, you also have...
I saw Barry Brandt walk up to a 55-foot Silver Eagle Tour bus, walk up to their road manager and go, "Where's the bus?"
Oh, my... I think I read that. What about...
You know, so I got along with him.
Yeah, what about Greg Jafria?
Oh, you mean Breck Boy?
That's...
He had a rough time on the road with us. There's so many little tiny things that you can do.
Yeah, well, I heard one story where...
anyone else, but it just throws a fly in the ointment for that kind of person. You know, and there's so much comedy in there because it shouldn't matter so much.
Well,
but it does.
I know there was one thing I read somewhere. I don't remember where either it was the roadies or one of you guys changed his hairspray bottle because he used to set up...
Behind his
keyboard.
Top cabinet of his stack behind the keyboard array, he had, you know, when the gods were working every week band, stuck on the back of our cabinets would be a Marine Corps fighting knife,
mm-hmm.
you know, things that could come up during the course of a show that you might need an extra tool.
Mm-hmm.
He had things like cans of hairspray and a lighted makeup mirror. So someone would, you know, let's say Barry would take a little drum solo. Fucking Greg would jump back there, and he'd be spraying his hair. Well, the hairspray, Breck turned into... Did Breck make the O5?
I don't know. I don't
One of his personal care assistants had $150 beautiful... double holster, Western holster rig, but the holsters were made for cans of VO5 hairspray.
Oh my God.
That was as faggy as you could possibly.
That's not a rock and roll guy.
You know, all the guys in my bands are carrying guns. This guy's got on holsters, and he's got, you know, VO5 cans in them. Anyway, they turned into spray adhesive one night.
Yeah. That's what I read. And his comb got stuck in his hair. I read that. I was like, "Oh, Rich, I gotta, you know, when I."
I've got a couple dozen more of those stories, but I don't know if they should be printed.
Dan Brewer from Grand Funk Railroad produced your first album, mm-hmm. but left after 3 days into producing your second God's LP, mm-hmm. Nothing Is Sacred. The result was you ended up producing the second album. What was
worst move I ever made?
Well, I like the second album a lot.
I like it too, but then again, I made it an album that I would like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a job of a producer is to hand something to the record company they can sell.
Yeah. What were the circumstances of Brewer's departure? And were you
had
obviously you weren't comfortable taking his spot.
Oh, I had to be talked into it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they stroked me and they bribed me. And they made me do it, and my ego loved it, and I have a good enough work ethic that I did the work necessary. I really wanted to, you know, show everybody concerned with the project that they could depend on me. But at the same time, I didn't know that Millennium, during that period, was getting ready to close and leave Casablanca. I didn't know that I was going to... here's a new producer walking out into the world with the finished tapes in his hand. He's got an ass-kicking, world-class, arena-class rock and roll band, and all of a sudden, in a four or five-day period, I lost my record company, got picked up by another record company, and not a single person at Casablanca knew who I was in Los Angeles. not a single one of them. None of the art people, none of the anything people. And here I am, the producer of this fucking LP.
Yeah.
It was the dumbest move that I ever made. You know, at the time, I didn't know any of these things. When it was all coming up, I got shit on by a bunch of people that go, hey, you know, leave Moore handling the hand, you know, leave him holding the bag. And it was really fucked. And it hurt my relationship with the other guys in the band. Because before, I was the guy that if any one of my guys as an individual was getting fucked with, was my job as a leader of the band to go take care of that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, how do you do that as a producer? I'm the leader of the band, but I'm also the guy, the producer, has got to say, hey, I'm sorry, there's four songs that you turned in. Only one of them's going to make the album.
Oh, boy.
Man, that was a whole different thing for me, and I didn't understand any of that going into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a better man for having gone through all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, everything's a learning experience.
It is.
I mean, you know, you go through things to learn something new about.
It's a shame, but it kept the momentum from the gods from carrying on.
Yeah.
Because the second album was pretty much, you know, there was only a half dozen songs on that thing that were new songs. The rest of them were outtakes from the first album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But still part of our live show.
A number of the tracks on Nothing is Sacred are intentionally misspelled. Was this in any way a tribute to Slade?
You know something? Odd that you would ask that, but when the Capital City Rockets, the week that we got signed by Elektra Records, we had just about worn out the Slade album.
Which one?
The one with, man, we're all crazy now.
Oh, Slade-est.
Oh, it was, I'm just listening to this stuff. Yeah, and there were more of them than one.
Oh, they're a great band.
I thought they were just straight in your face MC5 kind of band, and I love that shit. And we were very much into it, and I was sitting around with the guys up in Bearsville, where we recorded the second album, hanging out at Woodstock in Bearsville with all those old hippies and shit.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do real good up there.
Yeah.
And you know, we go up there, and they're going, hey, would you like to have a picnic in the woods? And we're going, yeah, what hunting season is it here?
Oh, God.
So they didn't understand us very well.
Mm-hmm.
But we were up there one night, and it was about the time where, as a producer, I had all this paperwork to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sitting up there, and we had fresh homemade chocolate chip cookies and beer.
Sounds
and it
good.
Was just a wonderful evening, and we all got a decent beer buzz going, and we decided to start doing a Slade spelling on shit. We turned in that sheet of paper, not even thinking that it was going to mean anything or anything, and all of a sudden, about 2 months later, to our surprise, they bought all of those spellings.
Oh.
Now, it was Slade influence. We were laughing about it, and we had we just had a ball misspelling all that stuff, doing it phonetically and all that shit. And I'm not sorry that we did it, but it wasn't a real big plan or for it to be a real big mystery or a thing or anything. It was just a goof.
Okay.
All right. This concludes part one of my interview with Eric Moore of The Gods. Stay tuned. There's more to come with Eric Moore.